Bei Action gibt es immer extrem niedrige Preise. Diese Woche 50 Palazzo Kaffeebecher XL-Packung nur 5,77 oder weiche Hotel Royal Handtücher nur 2,48. Angebote, die richtig glücklich machen. Für noch mehr extrem günstige Preise einfach in einer Action-Filiale vorbeischauen oder in der App stöbern. Action, kleine Preise, große Freude.
Will they find a home? Sponsored by Geico. Steve is intrigued by the paranormal.
Otherworldly spirits really make a house a home, you know?
Janice has different taste.
I'd like my house to not be haunted.
Compromise is tough, but these two won't have to compromise when they bundle home and car insurance with Geico. It's easy, and they could save even more. In the end, Steve and Janice found a renovated Victorian that's only haunted from 9 to 5.
Okay, wife's home. Y'all gotta bounce.
Bye, Steve.
Bundling without compromise at geico.com.
Hi, this is Tom from the Bob and Tom Show, and today's a little special event for me. This is going to be a podcast, an interview with a couple of guys about a very specific subject. If you're interested in the history of the ABA as it merged with the NBA, this is kind of a cool story. With me is Bob Nedelicki, the great basketball player, and the great sports writer, Robin Miller. So here we go.
Yeah, this is Tom. Let's introduce our guest. With me in the studio, we have a veteran sports writer and a television commentator, a man hated by many, which I think is probably a good thing. He is Robin Miller, and I've known Robin for many years. Robin and I met on a charity project many years ago, and it was a great success thanks to Robin. It was my first chance to meet a real IndyCar winner, Tom Sneva. One of our first albums, we produced it for the Jan Opperman Fund.
You kept the Opperman family alive, Tommy. You and Bob with your generosity, because they had no money. They were in their 80s, and Jan was a paraplegic. So, I remember you said, "Hey, is there anybody that needs help in racing?" And I said, "God, yeah, there's lots, but there's one guy that really needs it, and that's Jan Opperman." And
we took one of our stupid albums and with a lot of silly songs about racing that a lot of people hated.
Yep,
and put them out.
People loved.
And also in the room, we have Bob Nedelicki. I don't know Bob well, but I already dislike him because he's tall, handsome, slender, and has a great head of hair, and he's 10 years older than I am. So thanks.
And doesn't use shoe polish on his hair. It's not completely gray yet.
Yeah, I'm lucky. That's right. That's that one Budweiser a day.
That's it.
And then you haven't had a Budweiser in your whole life, right, Rob?
No, God, Tom, I gamble enough. That's a big enough bad habit. You don't have to drink or smoke or anything. Gambling is enough.
Now, Bob Nedelicki, a very fine basketball player, originally from Iowa. He was part of the original Indiana Pacer team. And you guys have a book out called We Changed the Game, and it's the true story of the beginnings of the Indiana Pacers and the ABA. And I want to start with a great story from the book. And it involves, you can give a little background before I think I let Bob tell the story, Robin, but the ABA was kind of like the AFL. They were a lesser league, and they were trying to get up to the top into the NBA. And there were talks of mergers, and there was a lawsuit. Now, so if you were a few years into the league, and the guys from the ABA sued the NBA, and what exactly happened?
Well, you got to remember that the NBA had 8 or 10 teams.
Eight teams in 66.
And the Indianapolis had a team called Indianapolis Kotskis, and they were successful. Then they had the Indianapolis Olympians, and they played in front of 12,000 people every week at Hinkle. Then their two star players got thrown out for shaving points at Kentucky, Alex Groza and Ralph Beard. So that went away. So we figured, well, you're never going to get another basketball team. They wanted $1 million to join the NBA.
And $1 million in 60.
In 1966 is probably like $10 million today. So Bob Collins, who was a sports writer of the Star, got together with Lynn Treese and a bunch of guys up in Lafayette, some Indianapolis businessmen, and they were sitting around drinking one night, and they said, "Hey, you know, we got a chance. There's a new league starting called the ABA, the American Basketball Association. It only costs $6,000 to join." So they all threw in $1,000. They flew to New York the next day, and that's how the Pacers – it was $6,000 to get in the ABA, and I think the franchise is now what's it worth now?
I think Forbes had it at $1.1 billion.
Yeah, $1.1 billion.
And did the ABA begin with the multicolored ball and the 3-point line right from the get go?
George Mikan was a hell of a player, and he was the first commissioner of the ABA. And he said, "I think we ought to have a red, white, and blue ball because it'll show up really good on television." Which was funny because they had no television contract, but he's like, "This would really look good."
Thinking ahead.
And then there was another guy that there was an ABL league, and he was from Anaheim, and he said, "Hey, I was part of this one league, and they got 3 points if you shot behind this line." So they said, "Okay, we'll do the red, white, and blue ball, and the 3-point line."
And the 3-point line, especially today, even the dullest observer such as myself can go, "Wow, that makes a big difference."
It's totally changed the game of basketball. You know,
originally they didn't want to do that. They were kind of all the owners said, "No way, we're doing a red, white, and blue ball." And Mikeum said, "If you don't do that, I'm out." And they wanted him because he was a huge name. And so they said, "Okay, we'll try it." And bingo, it worked.
So cut to a few years down the road, and I think you may be able to tell the story with only a limited amount of profanity. Somebody called a meeting, I think from the book, I remember it was in New York, and at the time the ABA was suing the NBA.
Right, that's when the merger hit. It was like 1970, it was the early part of 70, and Dick Tinkham was the president of the merger committee and actually president of the league, called a meeting because the NBA wanted to sit down. They sued the NBA, so they walked into the first meeting, the first ever merger meeting with the NBA, and they walked in the room, and Ned Irish, who was the head of their committee.
Was he from the Knicks?
He was with the New York Knicks, right. Big-time guy. Yeah, he was one of the part owners, and he was a big shot in the NBA. And Tinkham walked in, and to quote Dick, he said he walked in, and Irish stands up and says, quote, and actually one of our chapters is named this. He says, the first word spoken was, "Which one of you assholes is Tinkham?"
That's the name of our chapter. I think that's a great chapter.
And Dick kind of went, "That be me."
Yeah.
And he said, "Well, let me tell you something, Tinkham. First of all, we don't like being sued." And he said, if there is a merger, I'll tell you two things that will never, ever happen. He said, one, we'll never use that ball you use.
That beach ball.
And number two, we will never ever see a 3-point play in the NBA. Well, one out of two ain't
one
bad.
One out of two ain't bad.
And from my limited knowledge of this, which is extremely limited, I know a little bit from reading your book. And once again, the book is called We Change the Game by Bob Nedelicki and Dick Tinkham and Robin Miller. It would appear that they had a pretty good reason to sue the NBA because they had memos and stuff suggesting there was collusion among the teams involving was he then Lou Alcindor or
yes,
was he Kareem?
He was still Lou Alcindor.
They had conspired to make sure he didn't go to the ABA.
Right.
Is that correct?
And somebody with the Celtics, I don't know who it was, but had leaked this memo that they were pooling all their money together to get Lou Alcindor, which was an antitrust lawsuit they could do. And the best part of that 1970 thing was that everybody really agreed on the merger except the Knicks. The Knicks hated it, and the Lakers hated it.
And Red Auerbach.
Red Auerbach.
He hated everything.
He hated everybody. And the reason he hated Slick so bad is because Slick grabbed him and choked him.
Slick was going to kill him one night.
Slick is Slick Leonard, who is a legend in Indiana basketball and eventually became the coach and is alive to this day, alive and well. And
when Slick was coaching the Bullets, they had a guy named Luskatov play for Boston, and he went in and was roughing Terry Dischinger up. So Slick, at a timeout, walked down to the Boston bench in Boston Garden and grabbed what's his name by the neck
Auerbach.
And said, "If you do this again, I'm going to punch you out." And everybody just about passed out. And that's our boy Slick.
And Slick, and believe me,
but to get back to the merger thing, a guy named Sam Shulman, who owned the Seattle Supersonics at the time, he loved the ABA, and he went down to talk to Jack Kent Cook, and he said, "Look, Jack, here's the deal. If you don't vote for this merger, I'm going to move my team to LA, join the ABA, and we'll see who wins."
Yeah.
And next thing you know, Jack Hancock voted for it. The merger was completely signed off. It was a done deal in 1970.
And this what year is this?
1970.
It was a done deal. Oscar Robertson issue of some sort?
And then Oscar and a couple guys got together and filed a lawsuit because they liked the back and forth with the money and everything. And the lawsuit held the merger up for like 6 years.
It took 6 years then to get the merger.
And what makes me angry is had that merger gone through, we wouldn't be worrying about our pension thing.
Right.
We'd all be in the NBA.
And let me explain what you're talking about right now. One of the issues is that when the ABA merged with the NBA, there are a number of players now who are probably in their 70s and 80s.
Most of them are.
Don't have a pension. And they were kind of promised a pension. And what exactly happened
with
that?
Well, what happened was in the merger meeting, I was a player rep back then, and I would got out the year before, but I was informed everything. And they had a meeting in Hyannisport, and the two things holding up the merger, the four teams wanted to go in, but the player association said, you have to agree to two things. And the one thing was any player that has a no-cut contract that doesn't get picked up by a new team, you have to pay it. They said, okay, we'll do that. And they said, and another thing, all the players that have 3 years or more in the ABA will qualify. You have to fund them into the NBA pension plan. And they agreed to that. Well, 30 years later, when I went about 10 years ago and I went to check my pension, they had never done anything. They'd never funded it. And you have a problem. All the owners that back then are dead. There's a statute of limitations and the loss. It would take 30 years in a court to do something. And it's a darn shame. And the reason we're starting at this is 10 years ago, they went back to the guys like Bobby Leonard, pre-65 guys. There was no pension at all either. Even in the 40s, players in the BAA and the NBA gratuitously, which was nice of them, gave those guys a $300 a month pension per year they played. So if you played 4 years, you'd get $1,200. It doesn't seem like much, but a lot of these guys don't have a dime. That's a lot of money. Where the NBA pension right now, if you played 5 years, would be $10,000 a month. Mm-hmm. It's $2,000. And all we're asking for is, hey, just treat us the same. We're pioneers. Just treat us the same. Because I've in my travels in the last 10 years, I've seen guys literally living in cars that were good players.
And Jim Ligon, who played at Kokomo, one of the great high school basketball players, was living under a bridge when we had the ABA 20 years ago when we had the first ABA reunion.
And I mean, started this
living under a bridge.
We started campaigning for this thing with the NBA 10 years ago, and we had 92 guys eligible for pension. Now we have 100. We've had 90 guys die in the last 10 years.
No, you said 92. You had 192.
192, excuse me. 192. Now we have 100 left. And we've got, I know two more right now that have, one of them has leukemia and the other one's probably not going to live another month.
The cool thing is Bob Costas has really been helpful with Neto trying to push the NBA to do the right thing. I mean, Costas, he's a big ABA guy and he's
we've actually got a hold of the Player Association who pays half the money, and they're for us.
The current NBA Players Association would be happy to help.
We've talked to the lawyers, and they said, I've talked to Chris Paul, and he's on board. You know, he's a really nice guy. But it would cost, now the NBA next year is going to make around $14 billion, okay? And they sell our merchandise. It would cost the NBA to fund our pension, their part, less than $1 million
a year.
Wow. I would think that with all the, there's a lot of billionaires that own these teams that are very generous people. I would think would just, this would
and like the
be
owners,
a 1 hour meeting.
I don't think people know that much about it.
They don't.
And hopefully this summer with our Dropping Dimes, which part of our book goes to the foundation, Dropping Dimes, which helps the ABA, the attorneys there have agreed to do all the legal work for us for free. Bose McKinney downtown and Scott Tarter. And I know Scott is going to speak at the Player Association meeting in June, and I think Silver and everybody will be there. But he's got a great case to present, and the cost is minimal. And like I say, it is a finite number. 10 years from now.
Yeah, it'll be done.
I hope I'm around, but you never know. But there's guys a lot older than me. I mean, there's guys like Cincy Powell's 79, and some of these guys are in ill health, and it's a shame.
But the larger point is that the ABA really did change everything.
Oh, yeah.
Particularly everything. The 3 points.
That's what our book says.
And the interestingly enough, you mentioned that Bob Costas was a big fan. Was he a fan when he was living in St. Louis? Was he in high school then?
No, I think he graduated from Syracuse, and his first pro job was he was the voice of the St. Louis Spirits. Spirits of St. Louis, the ABA.
Right.
So he was
start.
An ABA announcer. That's how he started. And, you know, the Spirits of St.
Now,
Louis.
Isn't there some weird thing about whoever owned that team, they folded it, but they still get paid by the NBA?
Is their deal was the greatest sports deal in history.
All
back
time.
Then, they, instead of taking the $3 million that they were buying these people out at, they took $1 million cash and one-seventh of the four teams' television revenue in perpetuity. So far they had $300 million from the teams, and last summer the NBA they filed a lawsuit because they weren't paying them on the TV rights for cable and everything else. The NBA wrote them a check for $500 million
They finally sell it.
Right? And they've agreed that they can buy out, but they still haven't bought it out yet. Getting paid. That's a pretty good deal.
That's a pretty good deal.
but the players that are now elderly and built the team are getting
zero.
Nothing. That's
Here's
sad.
The thing, Tommy.
Who may I ask, Who is getting all that St. Louis money?
Well, the guy, and they're really good guys.
Two owners.
One of them's name. Ozzie Sillna and Dan Sillna. Ozzie passed away a year ago, and I talked to Dan at the reunion. He helped buy the rings, and then their attorney gets a piece of that action. And you know, and more power to them.
Yeah.
But if you're getting a check for $500 million, wouldn't you throw $1 million toward
Bob has talked to him about that, and I think they may be receptive about that. But you know, the thing of it is, also the NBA is very charitable. They're good people. They give away $200-300 million a year to charity, and so does the Player Association. I mean, to give $1 million to the guys that were pioneers. See, everybody thinks that, you know, I go somewhere and somebody will say, oh, man, what are you doing all the millions you made playing?
Man.
Hey, I was the highest paid player on the Pacer team the first year. I made $16,000.
16 grand, baby. You know what the per diem was, Tommy? $7 a day.
That was in the book. Now, in all fairness, $7 a day back in 67.
Well, it was but they flew commercial.
Tom, $16,000, and now an average player is making $16 million.
Of course,
inflation wasn't 1,000%.
Right.
It wasn't 100,000%.
But you guys were also inventing an entire new sport, really.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the great thing about the ABA was it was just such a Wild West show. Nobody knew who was going to make it. Teams folded and were moved within, you know, the first 2 years. We had all kinds of different franchises going all over the country. Everybody flew commercial. You got $7 a day per diem. There were, you know.
Can I mention something else that's in the book that made me crack up? There's a scene. One of the guys goes, I couldn't believe it. At halftime, there were guys smoking cigarettes and drinking in the locker room.
That was a guy named Peter Carey who became the sports editor at Sports Illustrated. He came to town to do the very first story in the ABA that Sports Illustrated was going to finally acknowledge him. The name of the story was Big Hit in the Funny League, and it was a picture of Neto doing a finger roll into the basket. It was back on about page 40. So Peter Carey came to town, and Mike Storen, who's the general manager, said, hey, Miller, I want you to take this guy with you for 3 days, take him to lunch, dinner, take him to practice, take him to the games, get him to know everybody. So we hung out, shot around at practice, went all over Indianapolis. Well, I asked Slick, I said, can I bring this guy in at halftime of the game? Slick says, I don't care. So he walks in. The first thing you do, you open the Pacer door, and you can't see because of the smoke, because Roger Brown's smoking, George McGinnis is smoking,
Darnell's
smoking. And then Neto and Roger and Mel were deputy sheriffs, which is a frightening thought if you think about it, because they all had a license to carry a gun. So they got their holsters on at halftime, and they're quick drawing each other. And Peter Carey from Sports Illustrated goes, what in the hell is – he goes, are they doing this for me, my benefit? No, I said, no, this is pretty much the way it is every night.
That's why Earl Monroe was a free agent. He came here, they were going to sign him, and he came in the locker room and walked right in right when Mel and Roger were drawing on each other, scared him to death.
The guys, it's Bob Nedelicki and Robin Miller. The book is called We Change the Game. I read it yesterday. There's another scene in there in which, one guy whose name I'm forgetting right now, from Detroit, eventually ended up getting murdered by his best friend in some kind of weird drug deal. And I guess he was this incredible player, but he wouldn't show up for games and very unreliable.
Neto got to be his roommate a couple times. Tell Tommy what he wanted to go.
Who's the shooter that he had to room with him one night?
Oh, Jimmy Rail.
And he eventually went and slept in the lobby because he had a loaded gun. He kept pointing it
out. Well, Jimmy woke up and heard this clicking noise, and he turned the light on. There's Reggie pointing the gun at him.
9mm pistol.
And he said, no, it was a 38.
Was it 38?
Yeah. And each one will work real good.
Yeah.
And he said, hey, Rail. He says, he was kidding him, of course. He says, I hear you don't like black guys. And Rail says, oh, no, Chad. Hey, let me see that gun, Reggie. He took it and he unloaded the gun and said, now you can have it back, and went back to sleep. About 5 minutes later, he heard click, 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 and he turned the light on there. Reggie was loading it back up with bullets. And he said Jimmy got up, went to get another room, and they were sold out. So he slept in the lobby. And I remember Slick came down for coffee. There's his player.
There's one of his starting guards.
Am I correct in saying he was an incredibly good shot?
Oh.
Rail? Jimmy Rail was a phenomenal player. Well, great, Mr. Basketball, played at IU, scored 56 points for the Hoosiers, one of the great outside shooters of all time. But the great thing about Reggie Harding was he went from high school to the Detroit Pistons, Tom. He was the first guy probably that ever did that. Went from high school to the Detroit Pistons. He's had so much potential.
He's a great player. He
Tell him about the time. Tell him about the
talent,
time you guys were
great talent. But he had. I woke up one morning and he's doing the rubber band around his arm. He was a heroin addict, and he's playing basketball, and he was still played great.
Yeah.
If he had had some direction, and somebody to guide him right, he would have been one of the great players.
Tom, he was paid $200 a game at the end of the season because of all the fines and all the games he missed. He owed the Pacers money the end of the year.
Well, Dick Tinkham, I think real quick on this, I wish he was here. Dick passed away that last fall. But Dick's the emphasis on this whole book. I used to go over to his house, and one day he was laughing. He was reading some book. Somebody wrote about the Pacers. And he said, everything in this book is not right. Let me tell you the real stories. And he started telling me these stories, especially the one where had we folded that 69, lost that 69 game against Kentucky, the team was folding the next day.
And yeah, let me give a little background on that. I think it's the opening chapter of the book, actually. There were some cash flow issues with the team. And as I understand it, nobody knew that, including the coaches.
Oh, Mike Storn.
Mike Storn, the general manager, and Slick, the coach, did not know.
They kept it. But the idea, if I'm recalling the story, they had to win this playoff game in order to have some more playoff games just to get enough cash flow to make their payroll.
Yes.
And if they hadn't won that, they would have gone away.
Dick told me that they had a meeting that morning. It was the seventh game of the playoffs against Kentucky. We were a 10-point underdog of that game. We were supposedly.
I can't believe that.
That's what they said, yeah.
I don't believe it.
Well, anyway.
Robin, of course, degenerate gambler.
Yeah.
Back to you, Bob.
Robin would have bet on Kentucky. So. But anyway, they had a meeting with bankruptcy attorneys that morning of the game, the board of directors, and they did, if we lose this game, we're filing chapter whatever 13 the next day. We're folding the team. Now, had they folded the team, they'd be able to fold it.
Yep. If the Pacers go down, Tommy, that's the end, because the Pacers were the cornerstone of the league by then.
And there was also a couple other instances where – Dick told me that in Minnesota that one time when the Denver guy was going to fold the team, and he took him in a bar at 10 in the morning and got him really ripe and kept the deal going until they had another owner coming in to buy. And some of the stories are just – it wouldn't happen today. It wouldn't happen today.
To put it in a little bit of perspective, in the last few months we've seen in the world of professional football a league started out by some people with some substantial amounts of cash, and it looks like it's over.
Gone. In 2 months.
Yeah. So and there are many other, the XFL, the USFL, that's obviously a different sport, but getting these leagues up and running is a huge deal. I wanted to touch on a little bit of Robin's background. You started writing about the Pacers from day one, is that right?
Well, I was 18 years old when I got hired at the Star, and I was answering score phones.
Did you even go to college?
I flunked out of Ball State.
Like he was 12.
And I looked like I was 12. So I kept telling our
sports. How did you get a gig at the Start?
No, I was just answering the score phones.
Wow.
When the gamblers would call in. That's how they found out who won the – I used to think, who cares who won the Brown-Harvard game? Jesus. Oh, they're betting on it. So one night half of the sports department called in sick because they were all drunk. So I went over to the sports department. The main office and answered the phone and took some basketball games. And they were like, well, you can do this. And I said, well, I was a sports writer in my high school paper. That's what I want to do. I want to be a sports writer. They're like, okay. So I don't think I was ever really officially hired, but I just kind of hung in there. So then I turned 19 and our sports editor, Bob Collins, was a big Pacer fan. And I started going out on my days off doing features and things like that. And Mike Storn, who was the general manager, is like, Christ, this guy's writing all these positive stories about us. So he said to me, he said, why don't you take your days off and go on the road with us? And I'll get you your own room, and we'll pay your expenses, and you can go, which is, you think about it now, I was 19 years old. I mean, it was like buying free PR. I mean, it was the great, every story I wrote was this glowing tribute about a player or something. But he was pretty smart because he's like, we'll get more publicity with this. We'll take this kid along with us.
Did he know that you had a pretty solid, forgive me for saying this, moral core? That you were not a drinker. I would think the average 19-year-old would have been so corrupted. No offense, man, Mr. Bob Nedelecki.
We tried.
They tried.
Because you're a non-drinker.
Right. And but you got to remember, the ace in the hole for me was the players were – when we think about it, I'm almost 70. We're not that much old. I mean, Mel and Roger and Neto, everybody was – it seemed like they were 15 or 20 years older than me, which they were only 5 or 6 years older. But like Neto said, I was 12. I looked like I was 12. I was a virgin. I was clueless about everything. And between Roger and Neto and Mel and Slick, I learned how to. I grew up pretty fast. But I had my own room on most of the road trips.
And I gave him a great nickname.
Hmm. Yeah.
Can we say it on the radio?
Sure.
Jimmy Olsen.
Jimmy Olsen, cub reporter.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's
Superman.
That's in the book. I thought it was going to be, you know, dickless or something.
No,
offensive.
No.
That didn't come till later. Okay, good.
But I had my own room on the road. Well, the guys were nice to me anyway, but when they found out I had my own room, they were really nice to me. They were like, hey, listen, we need to borrow your room for a couple hours. Why don't you, here's $5, why don't you go see a movie?
I saw a
whole lot of movies when I was 19 and 20. But the thing that's so cool is about the Pacers, Tom, which will never happen again. They flew commercial. Everybody hung out together. When the game was over, everybody went to the bar together, and they went to the restaurants together. And the coach and the players, there was no color barrier. There was no cliques. Everybody was buddies. And it was so cool to see because – then they became the ABA's power. They were the force to be beaten every year. And it just, Slick was the catalyst because they had talent. When Neto was first started, they had talent, but Larry Staverman was the coach, and he was a nice enough guy, but he just didn't have any, nobody really respected him. True Neto, I mean, really.
No.
And Slick came in, and, you know, he's like.
There is a great story in the book in which, as I understand it, there was an open tryout. And Indiana being a basketball mecca, 200 guys showed up. And I understand, I guess Slick put him through. Was it Slick that put him through the thing? And they were
right.
Because Slick wasn't the coach yet.
Nope.
He was guesting. Someone asked him to come, and guys were barfing on the court. And I guess none of those guys actually made the team.
One guy showed up and cut off bib overhalls.
So Slick goes, how are we going to get rid of all these guys? So if you missed, they had layup lines. If you missed a layup, you were cut. If you threw up, you were cut. So it was. But if we'd have had today's technology, Tom, if we'd had this, we'd have been some of the greatest videos of these guys trying out for the Pacers. I mean, it would have been phenomenal.
I don't know, Robin. If we'd had cell phones then, we'd all be in jail.
Well, yeah, you'd just be getting out of jail.
there are certain laws.
But
that
Tom,
we don't want to discuss.
Think about this. All these today's big stars have posses, and they all hang out. I mean, I shouldn't say that because I don't go. I've covered basketball a long time, but I can't imagine there will ever be a camaraderie like the Pacers had, and Slick being the catalyst for getting everybody together. And it was just a team. I mean, we played poker together. We went to the bar together, and we went to the restaurant together. I mean, they took me to – I remember one time we were in Houston or something. Neto and I were the only – it was an all-black bar, and Mel wanted to go, and we went, and they weren't going to let us in. And Mel said, we're not coming in if we can't take our buddies in. So they let us in, and it was just – it was such a cool time because
– And let's put the date on this. We're talking
– 70, 71, so 72.
Well, 68.
And that actually leads 70. To one of the most interesting things to me. And again, I wasn't around at this time, and so I don't know this, but there's a great chapter in the book about Netto's, and which was a bar that you were the, I guess, co-owner of.
Proprietor.
And it's my understanding that it was one of the – let me get this right.
I was the owner.
The only bar in which it was pretty much a both a black and white crowd.
Yep.
And what year did that start?
We opened in spring of 1970, right before we won the first championship. And I remember we had our opening night. We had our grand opening, and Mayor Luger showed up and a couple senators. I mean, you don't see that anymore. And that place, you know, back in the – people don't – around today don't understand the way it was in the 60s. I mean, it was a very tense time racially. There was no bar in Indianapolis where you could walk in and literally see black and whites together. And my bar changed everything.
It did.
Everybody got along. We had a blast. We had, you know, it was amazing. And I've talked to a few of the black leaders around town here, you know, older guys like me, and they said that the Pacers, along with that bar – was one of the best things that ever happened to Indianapolis as far as race relations went.
Tom, we got to back up too. And any, you know, lifelong resident of Indianapolis like I've been, all we ever had was the Indy 500. Now we had the Indianapolis Indians, but they weren't, I mean, they were our team because, you know, they'd been there forever and, you know, Victory Field, Busch Stadium, we had a cool ballpark, but we didn't have anybody that we really got behind. The Pacers were the very first team that Indianapolis ever decided. And when they won the first championship, it was like, this is our team finally. I mean, it was the very first time Indianapolis got behind a sports team and stayed behind it.
We should point out that Hinkle, of course, is the basketball, great legendary basketball arena on the Butler campus. But the Pacers were at the Coliseum, famous for the Beatles playing there, among other things.
Right.
And the Coliseum has been, the Coliseum has been completely redone.
Yeah.
But back in the day, that was your home.
Elvis played there one night, in like 73 or 72. I mean, I think it was 71, excuse me. And my band leader at my bar that night, he made an announcement. He said, Neto just called and said he and Elvis will be over in an hour and a half. Well, I drove into the parking lot with my girlfriend, and there must have been 500 cars there in that parking lot, and they were all waiting, and I got out, and they were very disappointed. Oh,
that's great. Where was Neto's?
It was in the Meadows Shopping Center, which is just about a block east of Keystone off 38th Street.
It was probably
three-fourths
of a mile from the Coliseum.
Right, and there was a real nice shopping center there. They had the Meadows apartments there, and it was really nice. Now it's all torn down, but... it was the bar that we bought, and your friend and my friend, Chick Perrin,
yeah.
They found about it. It used to be called the Crown Room. It was a nightclub called the Crown Room, and the funny part of it is Frank Sinatra had played there. All these big names had played there in the early 60s.
Right.
And it was pretty cool. And then we came in and changed it.
Other than Pineapple the Pimp and a couple of shady characters, it was the greatest collection. It was like going to Venice Beach. It was like one of everything showed up at Neto's. One night, Neto comes in, and he looks back, and it's Pat Summerall and Don Crickey. They're standing in line. There's like 40 people lined up to get in, and Neto goes, "What are you doing?" "Oh, come on, we're going to take you in the back door." And, of course, Neto was smart. I think the police drank for free, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. The funny part, it was a kind of a running joke that if you ever wanted a police car, just go up behind my bar because there used to be one or two of them running back there, and we'd have them in the back door, and Wendy, my manager, give him a beer, give him a coffee, whatever he wanted.
Tell Tom the story about how you took care of one of the referees one night who was longing for love. Come on.
You know that.
Well, you tell him.
I read it yesterday. This
wonderful,
is
wasn't it?
I would hope this wouldn't happen these days, but wait.
Oh.
Well, there's a guy. And
you don't have to name him.
He's passed away now, but him and his brother were both referees, but great guy. And he was in my bar, and in those days, they were there maybe a day or two ahead of time. And he was there a day and a half ahead of time. And he was in my bar, and he said, "No, do you know any women around town?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." So I called my little buddy Al Friedman out at the Speedway. I said, "Yeah," because he knew some of the really shady girls. "You know any girls?" "Well, there's this guy. He's a race driver's wife. He died, but she's a really wild one." So I said, "Well, can you fix this referee up with her?" "Oh, yeah." So anyway, make a long story short, the game comes out. I'm at the game, and he walks up to me. He's getting ready to throw the ball up, and he kind of walks up next to me. He says, Thanks, man. I said, "What are you talking about?" And next thing I know, I went to the hoop that night. I mean, I went to the hoop, laid the ball in. There wasn't anybody within 3 feet of me.
Whistle
blows. Foul. This guy's, "What? I didn't touch him." Anyway, he walks to the free throw line, hands it to me, and says, "Best time I ever had, man." I must have shot 20 free throws a night.
That's the way pro basketball should be.
The glory days of the
ABA. But the fun part about the book is, like Dick Tinkham says, and Robin can say this too, you know, we searched around, and Robin was the ideal person because he lived it. People that were there, not he said, she said, and there's so many stories out there in sports that, you know, my cousin's aunt told me that my brother said that this happened, and none of it really happened. And this, all this stuff in there is 100% true.
Once again, the book is called We Change the Game. Bob Nedelecki is talking to me, and Robin Miller, the journalist. Let me ask you to interrupt you for 1 second, Bob. Did you go back and look at your articles from the day back in the day, or do you just remember it all? Did you have a diary?
No, I had kept some diaries. I had a couple of notebooks that were full of notes and stuff, and I wrote so many stories. But, you know, calling guys like Oliver Darden and Jerry Harkness and Jimmy Rail and Ron Bonham, all the guys that started out with the Pacers, and then, of course, being with Neto a lot, and having Tinkham saved – he's got to hear everything, didn't he, Neto? He had boxes, Bob, of every transaction. The Pacers' very first television contract – from 1967-68,
we've got their total revenue.
Take a guess on what the Pacers' first TV contract was.
Maybe I didn't tell you, but the entire revenue, they TV'd the games the whole year. Now what is $1 billion they get? But the entire television revenue for 1967.
For the league?
For the Pacers.
That was paid by the television station for all the games for 1 year was $2,500.
$2,500, baby.
You couldn't buy a commercial.
Yeah, that's right. But wow. I think that's the thing that's interesting is that, again, you know, Slick didn't take the job when they first offered it. They wanted Slick to be the first coach, and he was working for Herf Jones, and he had a house in Kokomo, and he had five kids, and he's like, "I just quit basketball. I got this really good job. I'm not going to go down to this silly league that's going to last about 8 months, and then what I'm going to do is – when they offered him the second time, he said, I'm going to stay in Kokomo. I can commute and coach. And then I'll get enough money to buy furniture for our new house. And so when the league goes tits up, right, it'll be okay. I'll be all right. So even everybody that had a lot of basketball savvy wasn't sure it was going to make it. But after a couple years and you see these 150 to 148 games and you see how exciting it was to watch an ABA game compared to the stodgy old NBA where they're dribbling half court and they're backing guys down. The ABA, what did Walt Frazier say, Neto, the famous Knicks guard? What did he say the other day?
He said, I know Walt. He's a good guy. He said, the NBA, today's NBA is the ABA. And that's pretty good.
And that's Walt Frazier, who's one of the great guards of all time in the NBA.
I actually saw Mr. Frazier on the streets of New York.
Yeah,
I was going to college in the city during his era, and
Clyde, right?
I saw him in full Clyde regalia. I was walking down. I was actually kind of near the Dakota one day, walking around. All of a sudden, this guy gets out of a Rolls Royce in these furs. It was like a cartoon.
Yep.
Oh my God, Clyde! So I just screamed, "Clyde!" And he waves at me. Very easy to spot.
Yes.
Yes.
You know, another interesting thing in the book. The year we won the championship, first year, in 1970, you can take the entire 12 players' salaries, combine them for the whole year, the coaches and the trainers. And Chris Paul makes more.
Paul George.
Well, Chris Paul, too. Chris Paul makes more than Paul now.
I know.
But Chris Paul makes more in one quarter. Not one half, not one game, not six games. One quarter of one game.
The entire budget
for that year was. So you think about inflation.
Right. Yeah, even with inflation, it's a whole different.
It's pretty amazing.
It's a whole different world.
But the thing is, so many guys were just happy to have a chance. Like Jerry Harkness. He was on Loyola's NCAA champion, and then he went to the NBA, and he wasn't in shape, and they cut him. So he had a really good job. Where was his first job? Quaker Oats or somewhere?
Up
in Chicago. He was one of the first. He was going to be an executive at Quaker Oats, one of the first black men that ever had that opportunity. And his college coach said, hey, there's a league starting called the ABA. So Jerry came down here and tried out for it and made the team. But he was one of those guys that thought, I've spent my whole life being a good basketball player. I'm not going to pass. I'm going to take this opportunity and run with it. And so he made the team. And there were a lot of guys like that. Freddie Lewis, who was probably still the best point guard the Pacers have ever had, was a backup to Oscar Robertson in Cincinnati. So when this opportunity came up, hell yeah, I'll go play for the Pacers. You know, I'll make $16,000 or $17,000 and I'll get to start. But they took a chance because, there'd been all these different leagues tried to start and they never made it. So the ABA, they're thinking, well, is it going to make it or not? But I tell you what, there was a buzz about the American Basketball Association. HBO did a special, which wasn't bad, was it, Neto, a few years ago?
Yeah,
HBO did a pretty cool special about interviewing some of the guys that were still around that when it started. And Pat Boone owned one of the teams, and Pat Boone he won one of the first championships, I think, with the Oakland Oaks. And he was like, it was so much fun to go to a game because the ABA was the first one that had girls dancing during timeouts and stuff. And nobody, it was a fun league. And the NBA, there was nothing fun about the NBA.
When the merger finally happened, why only four teams?
I don't think that number one, they wanted $3 million to get in. And a couple of teams had folded that didn't have the money. Kentucky, they gave John Y. Brown $3 million, and he went and bought the Buffalo Braves and then bought the Celtics. They didn't want St. Louis, so they offered – actually, they could have bought St. Louis, but they offered that deal, that million, that monster deal. And really, two of the teams, San Diego had folded, and some other team had folded. I don't know who it was, but the Nets and the big market cities came. Whoever had the money got in.
How many of the guys that on the teams that folded ended up in the NBA after the fact?
Quite a few. The first All Star game in the NBA out of 22 players, 11 of them were ABA guys.
That was what was great. The very first after the merger, half of the NBA All Star team was ABA guys.
And the guy that led the league in steals was Don Boosie.
Yeah, when they first saw Dr. J, Tom, when they very first saw him in the NBA. And then you had Spencer Haywood, and you had Connie Hawkins, and Mel, and Roger, and Neto. And when the Pacers played an exhibition game, they had just won the championship, and the Knicks had just won the championship. They played the first exhibition game here between the ABA and the NBA at the Coliseum. It was packed, and the Knicks won by 2 or 3 points. But after the game, I remember doing a story with Walt Frazier and with
Slick played the bench the whole last quarter.
Right,
he didn't care.
But Walt Frazier and Willis Reed both said after the game, that's as good a team as we've played in a long. That these guys could obviously easily play in the NBA, and to have that endorsement from those guys who were the NBA champions.
That was 1971.
Yep, that's all you needed to hear.
I'm talking with Bob Nedelicki and Robin Miller, and Robin was a Cub reporter back in the day, and covered the Pacers. You've kind of segued into, I don't know when, but you became a real expert in the world of IndyCar racing, where you made most of your enemies.
Yeah,
as a writer.
Yeah, but you know, I started racing myself in '72, and I was writing a column a week on racing for the Indianapolis Star, and I was lucky because I'd work 7 days a week in the winter, and then the summer I'd just go racing myself. So I'd cover IndyCar racing and go race my USAC midget, and you know, there's nobody ever had a better life than I did. I got to cover the Pacers and the ABA, you know, cover the Indy 500 for 35 years for the Star, be on pit crews. I mean, you know.
Had some fun.
It had a lot of fun, but it was those kind of days. When you see, like I always tell these guys now, if you could have, you just wish people could have experienced what the ABA was like for a writer or a player or even a fan, because there's nothing like it now.
And I've kind of not brought up the most important aspect of this, in my opinion, which is with respect to the city of Indianapolis, there's a pretty solid argument to be made. If the Pacers had folded, and there wouldn't be a what's the next step? Market Square Arena?
Well, Market Square would never have been built. Downtown would have been a little slower. There'd been no Colts.
Certainly wouldn't have been a Colts. And I know Hudnut is the late great Mayor Bill Hudnut is featured in the book, right, as well.
And Luger and Hudnut were instrumental in this thing going forward, because the Pacers had kind of, you know, 9,123 people, the most you could put in the Coliseum at a night, although they sold dollar standing room only, so they'd get almost 10,000 in there for a playoff game.
They bribed the fire marshal.
Right. And they played, they always had to lay, they always left the ice down, didn't they, Neto, at the Coliseum? So they just put the floor over the ice, and it was a pit. You know, the Coliseum was an old dingy pit, really, but it was ours. So they decided, okay, the Pacers, it's time to expand. So Tinkham was talking to, who was going to, the guy Marriott. From LS? But the guy from LS Airs gave him some land for a dollar out where the Colts complex is, and said, why don't you build the arena out there?
Well, if they were going to build a Marriott Hotel.
If they were going to build a Marriott Hotel. So the Marriott people came to Indianapolis. They looked around. They said, well, we like the town, but we don't like West 56th Street. We want to be downtown. And so,
they went on the east side.
Well, but it ended up being on downtown. And so Tinkham's like, well, we're toast. And about 30 minutes later, Luger's office gets a hold of him and said, what would you think about building the arena downtown in Indianapolis? And Luger's like, that'd be a really – because Luger found $17 million some grant.
Luger said, we'll build it if you guys play there.
Yeah.
And Tinkham, you know, got a stiffy with that one.
Yeah. So,
I think the larger argument, again, is the history really is Pacers do great. MSA gets built. A lot of people, a lot of brains – see the future and roll the dice, and then of course the famous Colts story that we all know, and then there's a Hoosier Dome, and suddenly there's a
Super Bowl.
Yeah,
you got to give Hudnut humongous credit, because he built a stadium long before we had a team, and they were like, this will be your last term. You are done. Well, you're going to build us a stadium. We don't have a team.
What's pretty cool is before Mayor Hudnut passed and stuff, we got a statement from him in the book. We got a statement from Dick Luger in the book, which is from them, not just a writing.
Well, I spent an hour talking to Luger. He was fascinating.
But what really is the bottom line is one game determined the fate of downtown Indianapolis. And it may sound crazy, but
once again, had you lost that game, would have folded the league.
Been weird. You never know what would happen.
You never know. I mean,
And then again, I think one of the most important people on downtown, and again, he's passed away, but I want to give him credit, is Dick Tinkham. Without his, I mean, this guy, and I'm not going to say who, but the Pacers owners came to him and told him they were going to sell the team out of town in middle 70s, I think it was, right? They were going to sell it, and Dick says, I won't be a part of it. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to do that. And he's the one that went and found Jerry Buss. Jerry Buss said, I'll buy the Pacers. Nobody knows that. And then he's out in Hollywood with a party with Jack Kent Cook, and he says, I'm buying the Pacers. And Cook says, well, damn, I'd sell you the Lakers.
I didn't know you wanted a basketball team. Why don't you just buy the Lakers?
So he calls Sam Nassie. He said, man, you got to take the Pacers off my hands. I'm buying the Lakers. Just stories like that that nobody knows. And it was all Dick Tinkham's work that did that.
And the other thing that we can never thank Herb and Mel Simon they came to the rescue because we were done. In the early 80s, it was over. You guys came to town, right. It was over.
They had a buyer from, I think, either Kansas City or somewhere in the Midwest. They had a buyer that they were going to sell the team to if the Simons didn't buy it.
Were they going to move them?
The Simons were the last ditch effort.
If Mel and Herb had not stepped up and bought that team, it was moved.
And Mel and Herb were approached in the mid-70s about buying it, the mid to late 70s, and they said, well, we'd buy it, but we want the arena that goes with it, and they couldn't – whoever wrote the thing up, the arena was separate from the team. And
we won't
like,
mention his name, but it was the one GM that didn't know anything about anything, and he sold the rights to the arena to get the hockey team.
Which they told him, don't get a hockey team.
But to make a long story short, when Simons said it, Tucker went ahead and gave the Simons the deal and made the deal work.
Right, because – Mel and Herb, I can remember the press conference like it was yesterday. They said, you know, and Herb's really funny talking about it now. He says, God, he goes, my brother and I felt really cool that they came to us to save the team. And then we found out we're the last resort. But I mean, the millions of dollars they spent of their own money. Yeah, the Pacer franchise is worth maybe $1 billion now, but they've spent millions of dollars keeping this thing going. Back in the 80s when they put the curtain up and they only had 5,000 people because the team was horrible. The Simons, you can never, right. I mean, there should be, there's a statue of Larry Bird, and I'm like, that's crap. There ought to be a statue of Slick, and there ought to be a statue of the Simons out in front of the arena. Larry Bird didn't do anything for this team.
After reading the book, the statue of Slick will be next to a tap.
Yes.
No, he could have a...
you can have...
Well, like the story I said when he was coaching, and me and Mike Lewis went to a restaurant with him, a bar, and... We're on the exhibition game, and Mike and me and Slick are sitting there, and Slick waitress comes up, and Slick says, three gin tonics, and she starts to walk away, and he grabs her. He said, wait a minute, these guys haven't ordered yet.
What a classic. Let's talk a little bit about the gents that played in the ABA. Which of those guys went on to be the most successful in a non-basketball career? Do any of them come to mind?
Well, yeah, I can tell you. A couple, a guy named, when you get old, you can't remember things. George Tinsley from Kentucky, he started buying franchises. And he owns a bunch of – in airports all over Florida, he owns Kentucky Fried Chicken. He owns the Chili's, I think, down there. But he's got a whole bunch of – he's done really, really well.
So there are some success stories.
Oliver Darden of the Pacers did well. Oliver Darden started buying Burger – he bought Burger King's,
right,
and had like a bunch of them, and so he did very well.
He did very well.
Neto had a chance to buy into. Tell the McDonald's story, Neto. That's a good one. tell Tom this story. He will not. You will not believe this one.
I had my girlfriend at the time had her uncle lived in Hawaii at this beautiful new. It's called 3333 Ala Moana Boulevard. It was one of the first high rises in Honolulu, and he had a small penthouse. There was like four on the top floor. And I was with him, and he said he had this friend of his that owned all the McDonald's franchises for the Pacific. And he was going to go to lunch with him, and he said, Ray Kroc's going to be there. And I said, who's Ray Kroc? he owns da-da-da-da.
This is before McDonald's really took
off. Yeah, yeah. But this guy owned the whole Pacific. So we went out to eat, and this guy was a big – Kroc just bought the Angels or something. He was a big sports guy. And I said, man, I'd love to have a McDonald's franchise. He said, are you sure? And I said, I would love to. And to make a long story short, is he gave me a phone number to call, so I called the guy when I got back to Indy, and he said, "Oh yeah, Ray told me we'll do this, and you can have I could have had the north side of Indianapolis, but you got to buy one, then you have to sign up to buy two more, and then two more, you know." And I said, "Well, how much is it?" And he said, "Well, the franchise fee is like $100,000," and I thought he's nuts. You know, I say, "Oh, okay, click." I didn't realize you could go to a bank and say McDonald's and get anything you wanted. Oh, well. But that was my one big faux pas.
That not buying IBM when it was $4 a share. Well, that's another story.
Well, we can do this all day.
Oh, sure.
Well, another faux pas.
And he does.
They had this building had just been built, and they had a 4,000 square foot penthouse that was for sale overlooking Diamond Head. And they wanted $72,000 for it on the brochure.
Well, if you weren't so cheap,
you'd be rich. And he said, you ought to buy it. And I said, man, that's three times my salary at the Pacers. But the long story short is the guy called me years ago, and he said back in the – right before he died, Elvis bought it when he was out there and paid like $4 million.
Oh, sure.
That would have been 75-ish.
Yeah.
That's probably worth a lot more.
Oh, God, can you imagine? Out there, the real estate's crazy out there in Hawaii.
Once again, the book is called We Changed the Game, and it's a history of the early days of the Indiana Pacers and the ABA, told from a bunch of different perspectives. And there's everything happening in there. There's sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
It was kind of cleaned up a little bit, Tom, to protect the innocent.
Yes. But
well, there's stuff a little saltier than we've discussed on the radio.
Oh, yeah. But if you really talk to anybody that really knows basketball, and I've talked to NBA guys, you know, the NBA back then, when I started here at the ABA, there was no television. The only way you'd ever see a game would be a tape-delayed game.
The NBA Finals were on tape delay in 1966.
They had their ratings was worse than bowling back then.
Yeah, nobody watched.
And I think the ABA did what they had to. It's like the Indy. I always say the ABA is like the rear-engine car to Indianapolis. You had these big, slow roadsters that was the NBA. All of a sudden, here comes the ABA with these little rear-engine hot dog cars. They changed the game.
That's a pretty good analogy.
They changed the whole face of basketball, made it entertaining. Now, you go to a game, it's not just a basketball game. It's an entertainment venue. They got halftime shows. They got quarter shows. They got all-star games, dunk contests. And that's what makes the fans come.
Has the NBA ever brought back the colorful ball?
They did for a while. They used it in the three-point
shoot. They used it in the three-point
shoot. Yeah, okay. I knew I'd seen it. I couldn't remember where.
It was really funny. About 15, 20 years ago, me and Gary Pettigo decided we'd make some red, white, and blue balls and sell them. And we tried to get a credit or a patent on the ABA or not a patent.
Trademark
on the ABA thing. And somebody, they already got it. But it was funny. That year we came out with them, the NBA went and changed the color. They went to green and white and blue instead of, but now they use the red, white, and blue one.
But they use it for the last shot in the three. That's the last ball in the three-point contest.
Is there ABA merch out there? Is there a?
Oh yeah,
because I know in rock and roll these old T-shirts are worth a fortune.
We were supposed to, the NBA players, they all participate in the merchandising. They all get checks, big checks, every year for merchandising. And they sell ABA merchandise. The Pacers for years have sold my jersey, Mel's jersey, Freddie's, Roger's jerseys. And, we're supposed to get enumerated. Now, I'm not going to sit and cry about it, but, that's why we feel that we're as part of the league and we should get at least a little pension plan, something to help these guys out. Because there's a guy, I won't mention his name, but he's really good guard for Kentucky. Played 5 years. He got in a car accident about 10 years ago. And he is paralyzed on his left side, lives with his aunt, doesn't have $2 to rub together. Played 5 years. Now, $1,500 a month is nothing to these guys now, but it would be a life changer for him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think, hopefully they'll be a little more compassionate than they've been.
You'd think so.
Yeah, on a much lighter note, today basketball, one of the big deals is shoes.
Oh, God.
Did you? I'm guessing you didn't have a shoe. Were you guys all wearing the same shoes?
Hey, we got one of the first shoe deals ever with the Pacers. And Robin was part of it, believe it or not, because he was with our Cub reporter. We were playing in the first championship. We were playing in Los Angeles in 1970. The Lakers didn't make the playoffs that year, so we were it out in L.A. A guy named Ernie Severin, who was the honcho at Adidas, came to us and said, "We got this new leather, low-cut shoe. We'll make you guys a special kangaroo suede blue leather shoe. They're $200 a piece." And we were paying $12 for Converse, okay? We had to buy our own shoes, by the way, back then. And they said, if you guys will wear these in the championship, we'll give you each two pair. Man, we thought, you're kidding me. $400 for the shoes. And they even gave Robin.
They gave me a pair.
Gave Robin a pair.
Tommy, they were blue suede, and they were the color. They were so cool.
I know. I Scott Tarter's got my other pair. I never wore them, and he's going to put them in that museum downtown. But that was our shoe deal. We got two free pair. And I was talking to Artis Gilmore about a week ago because he was on this show, and Artis, we were laughing about that, and he said, "Yeah," he said, "when I went to the NBA, he said Adidas paid me $2,000." I said, "What, a game?" He said, "Nope, for the whole year." Whole year to wear the shoes.
Well, times have definitely changed.
Sure.
These kids out of college are getting $10 million just to lace them up.
Right.
Once again, Bob Nedelicki, former Pacer and certainly considered to be a Pacer great. Robin Miller, former Indianapolis Star journalist and currently doing some work with both NBC.
And Racer Magazine, thank God.
What about the players themselves? Who was the funniest guy in the ABA back in the day? Anybody come to mind on the Pacers that
Wendell
was
Ladd, Wendell Ladner and Steve Chubin.
Chubin? Well, I don't know about Ladner.
He was just kind of intense.
Like Wendell said, it was funny, Babe McCarthy said about Wendell. Wendell said something about, he said, well, Wendell, he doesn't know the meaning of the word fear. And Babe McCarthy's, his coach's reaction, yeah, and he doesn't know a lot of other words either.
Yeah.
he went over. Dan Issel told me he was flying. They were flying into Washington, D.C. one time, and they flew over the Washington Monument, and he poked, Wendell poked him and said, look, Dan, is that the Washington Monument? What do you call it? The Washington Post or something. Like, yeah, there's the Washington Post.
Going, reasonable.
There was a guy who played for the Pacers named Steve Chubin. Yeah, he was thrown out of Rhode Island University for something we can't discuss, but it was not heinous.
He was deported from Italy for he had a party one night and decided to burn his apartment building down.
I didn't know anything about women, but I watched him and I was in awe of. I mean, he was unbelievable because Neto used to do really well with it. Neto never lit anybody's cigarette or bought any girls drinks or anything. They just flocked to Neto, and he was the most hated man on the team because these guys would spend all night buying these chicks drinks and they leave the bar with Neto.
Hard and, okay,
so Chubin was just,
I was so innocent.
Chubin was just a charmer, and I remember one time we were flying and the guys were all playing poker. Everybody was playing poker, and Freddie Lewis and I I was making $111 a week at the Star, so after taxes it was like $64. So I was out of money by the time the thing taxied off the runway, because Slick was called Slick because he's the best gin rummy player and best poker player I've ever seen. That's why they called him Slick.
Wow.
So we're flying somewhere, and Chubin's saying to the guys, hey, you guys got any women in Miami? We're going to Miami, and nobody's even paying attention. Nobody even acknowledges he's talking to him. We get off the plane, and there is this vision. That's when you had to walk down the runway. There was no indoor boarding. We walked down,
the stairway thing?
Yep. And at the end of this thing is this beautiful girl in a sundress with no bra. This is 1970 or 60. And she going, Steve. And every one of the players grabbed Steve and said, hey. He goes, hey, you guys. Me and Jimmy Olsen are going to go have some fun. And I'm like, we are? We're going to go have some fun. Jimmy Olsen's going to get the call. Wrong. Jimmy Olsen went to about four movies that afternoon.
Wow.
But Chubin was, Tom, he was such a charming guy. I mean, he was such a likable guy.
Funny, too.
And he was funnier than hell. And, yeah, he was.
Could he play?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He was a 6'3", hard-nosed little, he'd drive to the basket and stuff. And they got rid of him for a guy named Ron Perry, and the city wasn't very happy about that.
No, they actually put, they had trade store signs.
Yeah, they brought signs to the arena. My dad called the Coliseum and said, I'll never go to another game. You got rid of Steve Chubin. He was the most popular Pacer. Even though he wasn't the star, he was such a likable guy.
There's a very odd, I'm not sure we can share it on the radio.
There's a story about a former Pacer. Again, I was right in the middle of that because I'm with Neto and Mel and Roger and this other guy, and we're going down to Mass Avenue to the Wishing Well to pick up this woman, and we're in Roger's Cadillac, weren't we, Neto, in the pink Cadillac?
I think so, yeah.
And this 6-foot bucks, this, she comes walking out, high heels, spiked heels, and these guys are all laughing, and I'm thinking, holy cow.
She was beautiful.
She was gorgeous. So she gets in, and we go to Neto's in the Meadows, and this player starts dancing, slow dancing with her, and they're all snickering and laughing, and so I'm asking Neto, what's so funny? And Neto goes, that's not a woman. Uh-huh. And I'm like, what? You know, I was 19. I was like, what do you mean that's not a woman? She's got high heels and a dress. What do you mean she's not a woman? And they're like, brother, that's a guy that wants to be a woman, okay?
This is in the early days.
This is in the early days,
anyone
Tom.
Anyone was really enlightened about the trans world.
So okay. Neto rescues our hero, this guy, and this guy wants to fight him because he goes, she likes me. And they're like, no, we'll explain it later. So in the meantime, another guy who used to play basketball starts slow dancing with her, and she goes up.
He wasn't a Pacer, though.
He wasn't a Pacer. He goes up to Neto. He goes, hey, this chick's all over me. She wants to take me out in the car. Give me your keys. So Neto gives him the keys. He walks out the door. Neto locks the door behind him. There's only one window at Neto's, and it was this big 7-foot. And it was like 15 guys stacked on top of each other to watch. About 10 minutes later, he comes out of that thing like a mortar shell because he reached down to the promised land and didn't get what he thought he was going to get.
Well, that's
and awkward. He vanished for 6 months. We didn't see him for 6 months. He's out there screaming at us, I'll get all you. Yeah. And it was, so finally, Neto and Mel and Roger had set me down about midnight. And
see, if we'd had a cell phone camera, see?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
But I finally kind of, I kind of understood what they were trying to say, but I was went home very perplexed.
Oh, no,
Lola.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. That's the best way to explain it. A different world.
Yes.
And different times, certainly.
But again, every night was an adventure at Netto's. Every night, Pineapple the Pimp.
Are there any memories of Netto's? Do you have any memorabilia? Do you have?
You know, I don't think I have too much. I've got some pictures, I had the signs.
Let me ask you
what
this:
whatever happened to them?
Do you still own the trademark to the name?
I don't think so.
Would
I never did
would
trademark
Netto's T-shirts?
Netto's in the Meadows.
Would those? I think there'd be a.
There might be a memorabilia thing for that, but I'll tell you, I do own the trademark for We Changed the Game.
That's right.
That's one thing I do own that.
Okay, I think I know in the world of rock T-shirts. The older T-shirts now are huge.
Yeah,
I would think for people who have listened to this podcast for this long, they're very devoted. Clearly, thank you for sticking with
us. For hanging in there.
I think. Do you still have a Netto's logo?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I've got some of those advertisements.
I've got a few of the old ads that used to run.
I got the picture of when we sponsored Johnny Parsons' sprint car.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Raceway Park. You know. I think that would be. Talk about cool and
that's
hip.
An idea.
Tommy, if you had a Netto's T-shirt on, because only the really enlightened are going to get it.
Well, and only the ones over 70, sadly, I think. Because when we go out, if we go somewhere to eat, you know, invariably one or two people will say, hey, Netto, man, I love the Pacers. So he's still recognizable. But sometimes he goes to the Pacer game and he'll go up to the suite and he'll talk to fans and stuff and they kind of heard of him and things like that. But a lot of the new Pacer fans that are in their 20s and 30s, I don't know that they know anything about Mel or Freddie or Roger or George McGinnis.
No. Yeah, well, I get that. I understand that. It's just that I'm in Netto, first of all, you look. I mean, you're still as tall as you were, very slender, full head of hair. You don't look you look a lot like yourself. Whereas
he's aged.
Whereas Robin and I look like we've been in some kind of serious accident.
That's right.
And we had a drunk plastic surgeon.
That's right.
We don't look like we looked in 1970.
No. You had long, wild blonde hair, and I remember you riding at the RCA Dome. You were riding. You had a race. You and Bob and Gary Lee and a bunch of guys rode motorcycles and had a race. Remember that?
We did all kinds of
around MSA. You know,
I was cleaning out my drawers the other day. I was cleaning a bunch of boxes, and I got about seven or eight of those. Your Bob and Tom discs, all different discs. You know, of all you got
of the CDs.
You guys, the CDs you made. Yeah,
we made 70 or something.
Let me tell you something.
Got a whole bunch of them.
We did both the tributes to everything, the Christmas, and then a lot of tributes to the Indianapolis 500. In fact, I'm dusting them off for the month of May. A lot of them
I'll
are still valid.
Everybody, what was cool about the Bob and Tom show? Because I worked with Bob and Tom and Jay Baker in the month of May for like 7 years, and Dick's Picks. Was everybody in Gasoline Alley had Dick's Picks on at 5 till 10. And Tom, bless his heart, trying to put the show together, you know, it's 5 till 10, it's 4 till 10. He's like, here comes Baker, shows up at the last minute. You never knew what Tom was like, what's he going to talk about today?
We'd have some very good guests, many of them fake.
Yes.
And they wouldn't know if we had the real
right.
Mario. They didn't know if it was Robin.
You know, I started working at the auction in 86. You know, and that's when I get up at 6:30 in the morning, which is unusual for me. Every morning driving to work, that's who I listen to. And a funny story is Mel Daniels called me one day and he says, "How about giving me a job at the auction?" And I said, "You really seriously?" He said, "Yeah, yeah." And I said, "Okay." I said, "But you have to be here at 8:00." And there's this long pause. He said, "Why?" I said, "Because that's when we start work." Oh no, I can't do that.
Thanks anyway. But you know what? It was. Everybody in Gasoline Alley listened to the Bob and Tom show. Now, you think about that today and the way radio's fractured and there's so many different avenues to go to. That was so cool that, like, one time Al Unser drove in and Tony George said to Al Unser, "God, I heard you on Bob and Tom this morning. You were hysterical." And Al Unser's like, "I haven't been on the radio all month."
I was going to wear my T-shirt today. I got three or four, but I got the one with the fuzzy navel open you guys had.
Sure.
Remember that? I got the T-shirt, but it's too cold out there to wear. I got the golf shirt.
I think maybe we should try the Netto's T-shirt. I think that'd be pretty cool. I mean, again, it would be a very obscure,
hip element
out there.
It would be. As much money as I've lost making T-shirts, why not? What's another one? It's okay.
Okay. Now, on a personal note, Robin, do you mind if I ask you the status of your health? I mean, you look like you're doing fine.
Oh, yeah. I just
– you had a little bit of a pretty serious scare.
I think anytime, you know, you go see the oncologist and they give you chemo and then they say, okay, take these pills. I got lucky because in 6 months my cancer went into remission.
And the specific type is?
Multiple myeloma. It's cancer of the back, bone cancer of the back.
But the prognosis is pretty good at this point?
Well, if you take your pills every day, you can probably live another 8 to 10 years. And, hell, I don't want to be any older than Neto. I'd be thrilled to get to almost 8.
No, but it's amazing the advances. I've read up on what Robin had and the way they treat it now. In the old days, they used to just they actually take your bone marrow out, treat it, put it back in. And it's great. A really, really amazing thing.
And now it's like a blood
do.
Transfusion. They take your bad blood and your good blood and they separate it. They harvest it for 3 months, and then the stem cell is actually a 30-minute procedure where they put your good blood back in you. That's what it was.
Yeah. Well, we're glad you're doing well. The book, once again, We Change the Game. Lots of great stories. A few of them have just been told on this podcast. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tommy.
And the obvious question, is this available at Amazon? Where does one
find
it?
It's available on Amazon. The Pacers gift shop has it.
HiltonPub.com Hilton is the best.
The best way to buy it, though, is HiltonPub.com because they don't get you all the Amazon fees and stuff.
Right.
And it's the same deal. But if you go to Amazon, it still says HiltonPub.com,
does
I think.
It? Does
I don't know if it does or not. But Hilton, you can. We have a website. We have a website, WeChangeTheGame.com.
It's on there.
It's on there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The good thing is, Tommy, is that Steve Simon, who will eventually take over and run the Pacers, is a huge fan of the ABA, and he...
Great guy.
Neto and I had lunch with him and his dad, Herb, and he said, you know, he wants... They're going to buy several thousand and pass them out for fan appreciation night.
Well, that's great.
And the thing of it, it's the history of this team in this city, and it's only $25, and like you almost read the whole thing in one day yesterday. It's about a 4 or 5 hour read. And it's the thing of it is everybody that's got it, just they end up laughing and they're going, God, that sounds like so much fun. That was the whole reason to write the book.
Right.
It was fun.
When Tinkham first said it, he says, I don't want to do this unless it's a lot of fun. He said, I want to have fun doing it. I don't want to, you know, we're not in it to make a ton of money. We just want to have fun. You know?
There's a lot of joy going on.
Yeah.
It's not just a bunch of stats. It's and crazy stories, some sad, some not so sad, some hilarious.
Think about this, Tommy. Neto made his home here. Mel Daniels made his home here. Roger Brown made his home here. Freddie for a long time. Once guys got in the Pacer organization and family, and they fell in love with the town, they stayed, which is that's unusual too.
Sorry, and again, the big point is that without the Pacers, all of this transition of turning Indianapolis into a serious city wouldn't have happened.
We probably shouldn't say it wouldn't have happened. It just wouldn't have happened.
It would have taken a hell of a lot longer than it did.
If
there's no Market Square Arena,
yeah. Yeah.
There's no dome. There's no Colts.
Because at that point, you're right, because there was no impetus for anybody to try it. Dick Luger was the shining knight.
Last of the hotels was closing downtown, remember?
Yeah.
All the hotels, they had no rooms.
We had 450 rooms, I think, in downtown Indy in 1967. Because the Claypool had just burned.
Yep.
The Claypool Hotel had just burned. So Dick Luger, bless his heart, I mean, he was a big Pacer fan, and he was like, we've got to keep this team going. We got to somehow keep this team going.
A guy that I know went to high school with Dick Luger, and he always tells me Dick Luger's the smartest guy he's ever met in his life.
Three smartest people: Dick Luger, Mitch Daniels, and Roger Penske.
Yeah, I'll bet. I agree with that.
Are you on good speaking terms with Roger now?
Sure.
Good.
I mean,
you looking forward to the 103rd running of the Indy 500?
Yeah, just because I think it's going to be just like last weekend. The great thing about IndyCar racing, Tommy, and you've been to enough races. We don't know who's going to win the pole. We don't know who's going to win the race. That's why you watch. It's not like, you know, Kyle Busch wins every NASCAR race this year. Formula One's got two teams that win every race. IndyCar, Sato won last week, and him and Graham Rahal were on the front row, and Penske was in the back. I mean,
well, yeah, the kid the week before, Herta.
And then you have an 18-year-old Colton Herta wins at Austin, Texas. So we just got to do something about getting the TV rate. We got to get more people to try and watch this because the racing's really good right
moving
now.
Moving to or has moved to NBC. Do you think the Indy 500 will ever be able to move to nighttime? Wouldn't that double the ratings?
It would. Tom, you just hit the one point that people seem to... The Daytona 500 comes on in February when there's no competition. It's on at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It gets 9 million people to watch it. It took them an hour and 10 minutes to run the last 10 laps. I mean, it was laughable. It was not a race. It was a joke. Indy runs at 11 in the morning on Memorial Day. If it's a nice day on Memorial Day, you're going to take your family.
Well, it changes to 12.
12. You're going to take your family. You're not going to sit home and watch television if it's a nice day on Memorial Day. So the one way you could probably get TV ratings is everybody's like, oh, you can't run Indy at night. And I'm like an old school guy, and I hate to see it. But if it doubled the ratings, I'd do it in a heartbeat.
Yeah. Well, they've gradually, the old school guys have been getting outvoted.
Yes.
They moved carb day to Friday.
Yep.
A brilliant move. They
yep.
shortened the
yep.
They shortened the whole month of May.
Yeah.
Not literally, but.
But they had to. And, you know, when you guys first came to town, I mean, practice days were big and qualifying days were 100,000 people. I mean, you just.
More.
Yeah. You just couldn't even imagine how many people.
Well, it was 30 days in May. We go out yeah. there every day. As soon as yeah. the thing's over, we play softball.
Yeah.
But you can't go back to that. But I guess my point is that a lot of people there are very bright and they're looking at various things that could be done. I know I heard someone say, well, they couldn't get the crowd out safely in the dark.
Oh, Christ.
Well, I don't know. That seems like
the thing is, I was talking to Mark Miles about lighting the speedway, and the bill for lights is astronomical. But, you know, mm-hmm. you sometimes you have to go, okay, what can we do? Indy still sells. There's still 200,000 people at the Indy 500. Can we, you know, the last 3 years, the TV ratings have gone down every year. So hopefully NBC bringing in Mike Tirico and Dale Earnhardt Jr. and Danica and promoting it like they have are going to help turn things around. Not overnight, but I just can't believe that we're not going to have a better rating than we've had the last 3 or 4 years.
Okay. And I think we could wrap up. Your favorite IndyCar drivers in the last, say, 50 years, do you have, with respect to not necessarily their skill or just great personalities?
Who
do you
AJ, like the most? Mario, Tom Sneva. Bobby Unser.
JR.
John Rutherford. But what you got with those guys are guys that will say whatever comes to their mind, just like you or him or me, and people don't do that anymore because they have sponsors and they're worried about somebody saying. I mean, Foyt to me, I mean.
Politically correct, Robin.
But yeah, but right. The great thing about Foyt is he's just, there's never been anybody like him. And he's so funny. And let's see, last month.
Yeah, and he tells it like it is.
Well, he wants to see it. Like he hopes it is. The other, like a month ago, he backed his bulldozer into some quicksand. I mean, he's cheated death 100 times in and out of race cars. And Mario is just the most classy, as you know, he's been on your show. He's the best spokesperson, him and Rutherford, probably, for racing.
And this is the 50th anniversary of Mario's win.
Yes.
Right?
Which is cool.
It was 69.
Because he's such a great ambassador, and he's so eloquent. And whenever there's a story to be written about somebody passing on or some breakthrough in racing, he's the first guy we call because he frames it so well because he's done it all. And Foyt's the same way. It's just that AJ's, you know, he's and Bobby Unser will say anything. And he's so funny because, you know, he believes it. So, you know, that's even better. So Sneva was probably – those guys were all from the 60s. Tom was from the 70s, and Tom was almost – he got in trouble sometimes because he always said what was on his mind and didn't really care if anybody liked him or not. I mean, that's kind of refreshing. You just don't see
Bobby
that
Unser almost got me arrested a lot of times. I went around with him. He used to come to my bar, and I drove with him a few times, and he did one thing he would never do. He never stopped for stoplights or stop signs unless there was a car going across. I said, what are you doing? He said, well, there's nobody coming. And then I started doing it. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to get arrested because he never – I mean, if it was a red light, he didn't care. He'd swear through it. And then, you know, the rental car deal with him, you know, when he got barred from renting cars.
They couldn't rent cars from Hertz or Avis, him and Al Unser. Hey, banned for 2 years.
By the way, guys, that phone call I just got, guess who just called me? Bobby Plump. There's a basketball
right.
name.
Speaking of great guys – But you know what? Those are the guys, Tom, when they come to town in May, Parnelli is another one. When they're gone, I don't know, that's it. Those are the gunfighters of our lifetime. They survived the darkest, toughest days of racing when they killed one or two guys a week in sprints, midgets, and Indy cars. They all survived. They all became great drivers, and they're all still alive, and they're all just... When they come to Indianapolis and people just go, you know, Parnelli's so funny. He's like, I can't believe anybody knows who I am. It's like, Parnelli. But they still mean so much to people. And I don't Scott Dixon's as good a driver as I've seen in the last 25 years. He can walk into any restaurant in Indianapolis and nobody knows who he is.
Hey,
and that's kind of sad.
He's also a great guy, by the way.
Phenomenal guy.
I'll tell you a great Foyt story. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'll tell you a great Foyt story. This is back in the early 70s, or you know, they had the Hoosier 100. They had a sprint car race. They have a sprint car race at the fairgrounds. Two nights before the 500. What was it called, Robin? They had a midget race and they had a sprint car.
Oh, yeah,
race.
The Holman Classic.
Holman Classic, whatever it was. Well, we were playing poker with Foyt in a poker table at the Speedway Motel, and some guy started giving him crap, said, "Why aren't you driving your sprint car in the thing? Are you chicken?"
Oh.
And Foyt said, "What?" He said, "Are you chicken?" Well, next thing they know that he went in the other room, called Texas. They ran his sprint car up here, and he drove it. And I think he won both of them. I think he won both features. But he said, "Well, I'll go get my car," and bingo, he brings it up and wins both features, and then goes. Those guys have. I mean, I admire them so much. It's a whole different breed.
How is AJ Foyt's health?
Good. He's 85, and he looks as good. I mean, he's put a lot of weight back on, but he looks really good. His color's good. Every day he's at the shop in Houston, or he's at his ranch on his bulldozers. He's got four farms now, four ranches now.
And he just likes to bulldoze stuff around.
He just likes to knock trees over and drive around. And so I'm trying to put a deal together for NBC that we're going to take Scott Dixon to Houston and have AJ show him how to drive a bulldozer, which I think will be fun.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. But again, Mario's still a spokesperson. He still drives for Firestone. He still drives the two-seater at the IndyCar races. Uncle Bobby can't walk. He's in a three-wheeled cart now. His back is junk, so he can't walk. But his mouth still works. He's, geez, there's you. If Bobby Unser calls you, Tom, and you look at your watch and you go, "Oh God, do I have an hour? Oh no, Uncle Bobby, we can talk for 20 minutes. I got to do a radio show with Tom Griswold." Is that okay? Okay, great. I mean, Bobby's the greatest because he's fantastic. Got so many fabulous stories, and they're all. I did a column a few years ago with Dan Gurney, Mario, Uncle Bobby, Parnelli, and AJ. I called them all on July 4th, and they all answered the phone. And I just said, for a kid that grew up idolizing these guys, and then I covered them and then became friends with them. I said, I cherish it. Every time I talk to these guys, I cherish the moment because I know you can't. They're going to be here forever, and they're just special people.
What do you say we take these mics out in the month of May, and maybe we can get two or three of them and have a one-hour podcast, because this format allows people to really get loose and tell stories that they might not get, because a lot of the stuff probably hasn't been captured.
You know where you're at?
I can, if we can,
Robin,
get, if
you got to take them over to Charlie Brown some Friday.
Well, maybe, but it's too noisy. Yeah. Bobby Unser and Parnelli, this is probably the last year they're coming. So if you come out there, we'll put something together.
Sure.
With those, because
I'd love to come out.
Parnelli's the reason that Bobby Unser exists, because he brought him to Indy. So we blame Parnell.
A real quick story. My mom, who's no longer with us, my mother knew nothing about racing. I'm sure never saw a race in her life. Whenever someone would be going too fast, she would always go, "Hey, Parnelli, slow down." So he was literally part of the language of this country in the 60s.
You know, the one guy I really miss is old Rube, though. Remember Lloyd Ruby?
Lloyd Ruby. I worked for him for two summers.
Isn't there a picture of you with Lloyd Ruby in the book?
Yeah, me and Bobby Unser.
Yeah,
me and
in the
Ruby.
Book.
I'll tell you a quick story about old Rube. You know, Rube liked to partake in alcohol a little bit, like a lot.
Only 13 or 14 hours a day.
Yeah, and he would come in my bar, and, you know, the next morning he'd have to go out and race or qualify or just practice, and he'd be just, you know, after about 35 whiskeys, he'd be looking at me kind of funny. And finally I went up to him. I said, "Man, how do you drive those cars tomorrow when you feel like this?" And he said, "Well, Neto," he says, "what I do," he says, "I go out and take my warm-up lap, and then when I come off at turn four, I look down the straightaway. And if it's straight, I floor it. If it's all curvy, I pull in the pit."
Whoa.
I worked for him for two summers on his pit crew, and I wasn't allowed to touch the car. And Rube, even though he'd be a little bit inebriated, knew that. So one night, we're changing the rear end up Michigan, which is a fast joint, and Rube comes stumbling about 11 o'clock, and he looks down, and he sees me sitting behind the car, and he goes, "Robin's not supposed to touch the car." And I go, "Relax, Rube. I'm just handing him wrenches." So the next day he finished third, so I went up to him after the race. I said, "See? He had nothing to worry about." But Rube, there's nobody that ever drank. I mean, I've never seen any. I don't know anything about drinking, but I know whiskey cannot be that easy to get rid of, right? I mean, you have to have a hangover.
No, I don't.
Hearing about it, I feel terrible.
But those guys live for the moment, Tommy, because they didn't know. Their life expectancy of an IndyCar driver in the 50s and 60s was about 3 years. So they were pretty much, they said, We're going to live it up. We're gassing it now, every week.
Remember the saying? Remember the saying? There's old drivers and there's bold drivers, but there's no old bold drivers.
Right. And when the ambulance went out of the speedway with a driver, if it turned left, it went to Methodist Hospital. If it turned right, it went to Conkle's Funeral Home. I mean, that's how it was. That's how bad it was.
Yeah, I heard an interview with JR a couple years ago, and I couldn't get over the fact that every couple weeks when they were driving pre-Indy, they
sprinting
were
midgets.
Somebody was dying.
Yeah.
I had a lot of friends, you know, Robin, especially Robin friends, but I had a lot, you know, I knew a lot of those guys, you know, boom, you never knew they would be.
But when I first started hanging around racing in the mid to late 60s, they would bury somebody every other week, a midget, or sprint car driver, or an Indy car driver. And, you know, Art Pollard's the guy that really got me into racing.
That's what I was thinking
about, Art. And he got killed in Indy in 73. And now, thankfully, racing's become so safe. So when somebody does lose their life, it's like people go into shock. I mean, when Dan Weldon got killed in 2011 at Vegas, the whole paddock just, I mean, it was like they were in shock. And you're thinking, folks, these are 200-mile-an-hour open-wheel race cars. I mean, they're still very dangerous.
It was a very close call. Was it 2 years ago?
Scott Dixon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was terrifying.
Yeah. I mean, it thankfully landed perfectly.
Let me rephrase it. Today's drivers wouldn't show up hungover. Is that safe to say?
That is very safe to say.
They work out.
They eat healthy food. We're...
It's kind of like today's basketball players.
Well, you know what? Now, this is something I have heard. I don't know this to be a fact. But apparently the existence of Tinder and the various social media ways of meeting the ladies have apparently made road games. The road teams are a lot better. Someone told me statistically that the road wins are up because these guys don't have to spend so much time having their posses hunt for ladies. This is apparently a statistical fact. I'll have to do more research.
I don't doubt it.
Yeah, I remember Chico Vaughn. You'd go up and say hi to him before the game started, and you know, woo. Chico would, he'd have a couple shots of bourbon for you.
Okay, one more quick ABA story. So,
by the way, there are several photographs in this where there's a lot of booze visible, and they're in the locker room.
Yes.
And I don't think it's, I think it's halftime.
The Slick time, the great picture of Slick with a cigarette and a beer chewing Mel Daniels out at halftime is perfect. That's it. So, because I was young and single and, you know, I mean, I do whatever the boys want me to do. We go to Pittsburgh once, and Roger and Freddie.
Oh.
it's one of their birthdays, so their wives show up to Pittsburgh to surprise them. Well, they surprise them all right because their Pittsburgh girlfriends were also. So before the game starts, there's four sets of hands waving at them, and Slick's trying to talk to them, and they're looking across the court, and they're going, "Jesus Christ, what?" So at halftime, Roger gives me he goes, "Look, here's $20. I want you to take these two girls to a bar after the game, and you tell them that we had a team meeting, and we'll be there in a little while, blah, blah, blah." Well, of course, they never showed up, and these
the wives showed up unexpectedly.
After the game, they had to go out with the wives, so I'm with the two gals, they really wanted to hang out with me, as you can imagine, and they're getting madder by the second. So just a typical ABA night, because those were the days when the team spent the night in that city. They didn't fly out like they do now.
Well, I've got a video of the championship series out in Anaheim. In the third game, we were up 2-1 in 70, and this girl sent a note into the locker room. And it said, "Roger, I'm so-and-so, and I really want to be with you tonight. If you really want to meet me, the first time you touch the ball, shoot a three-pointer." And this is on the video. Mel tipped it to Roger on purpose. He tipped it to Roger. Roger took one step and fired a three, but he hit it. That was the thing. He hit it.
Oh, it was like a 40-footer.
That's like a
40-footer.
Kind of like a Disney film, except totally different.
Right, right.
That's
great.
It's just, what a story.
It was just one story like that after the night. It was a time that'll never probably be repeated. Tinder, though, that's an interesting concept.
Yeah, that story comes. I'm trying to think of the source on that, but that's what I understand. That's a big thing now. We were talking with John Feinstein, the sports writer from the Washington
Fabulous
Post.
Writer.
And he was. I asked him, if you could be a professional athlete, what would it be? And he was saying he would go for baseball because
you're a reliever.
the least amount of injuries, probably. Potentially a long career, whereas in football, of course, careers can be very, very short. It's very dangerous. But he said, basketball, these guys in the NBA, the traveling is brutal. even with their own plane, and they're flying all over the place. It's a long season. The games are tough. And these guys, they're making a great deal of money, but they are some of the best athletes in the world.
Sure. Think about baseball, Tommy. You're in the same city for 4 days. I mean, and if, like Neto said, if you're a relief pitcher, you might pitch and you might not. So you're in the same city for 4 days. You're not getting up at 4 a.m. to fly. I think baseball would be pretty. Pro golf wouldn't be bad either if you're a good golfer.
I think the stress level of golf would be absurd.
But your big injuries are calluses on your hands and maybe you hurt your back. Yeah, that'd be about it.
How about you? Any sport you could do? Would you want to be a race car driver? Do you think you have that?
I mean, I wasn't off. I was just not very smart. I wasn't a very smart driver. I crashed too much. I took too many stupid chances. I think I had some ability, but you have to judge. Vince Welch is a good example. He's an announcer at Fox for the NASCAR, and he used to work at Channel 8. His son, Dylan, who's going to work with us at NBC in the second half of the IndyCar season, is a hell of a little race driver. Yet he got to a certain point in USAC and said, I'll never be able to make a career out of this, so I'm going to get into broadcasting. So that's what he did. And I just applaud that because there are so few people that can make it as a race driver. It's so unrealistic to think that can happen because it's so expensive.
Well, you know, I remember Scott Goodyear, I was out with Pettigo at the Speedway one time, and Scott Goodyear was looking at a couple drivers that they were testing up and coming.
Right.
And I never forget that he was watching this one kid go through. It was supposed to be a pretty good kid, and his comment was, you know, he better find another line of work.
Yeah.
Because you could tell. You know, when you get to that level, baby, you got to be.
It's just that there's a lot of good race drivers, but there's a lot of guys that can drive race cars, and then there's very few racers that know how to win. That's the key. My specialty were 8 and 10 lap heat racers because that's about all I could concentrate. I could be pretty good for 8 or 10 laps, but 40 or 50 or 100, you know, that's what really separates really good drivers, the guys that can concentrate that long. I mean, and keep your focus and stay in the groove and don't ever. I mean, it's more challenging than people think, and especially in an Indy car because there's no power steering. And these guys, it beats the hell out of them. I mean, last week at Barber in Birmingham, Alabama, that track up and down, all these tight corners. I mean, these guys are worn out after the race is over.
Okay, now you gave me your top five or six. I'm not sure how many. If you had to say that the best technical drivers in the memory of you, since you've been covering it since whatever 1970-ish, I assume Rick Mears is up in that group.
AJ Foyt, Mario Andretti, Bobby Unser, Rick Mears,
in that order.
And well, not necessarily in that order. Just that Foyt could build his own engines, build his own car. I mean, Foyt could do everything, and he knew the inside of a race car. Mario would say, you know, give me 2 clicks on a right front shock. Mario, he just drove guys like, how would you know that? And Bobby Unser was another guy. I'm a self-taught engineer, honey. That's what he used to tell us. We're like, we got it. You flunked out of the eighth grade, Unser. We understand that. But he was really savvy about a chassis. And Mears was just – Rick was one of these guys that came out of desert racing and had this amazing aptitude to study what the car felt. I mean, Rick would come in after a lap, and he'd tell them exactly what it was doing in each corner, and they were, like, blown away. So there are other guys like Gordon Johncock who couldn't tell you – Lloyd Ruby and Gordon Johncock could not tell you anything about a race car. They just drove the hell out of it. So Bobby Unser used to say, if Johncock could have set a race car up like I could have, he'd have won the Indy 500 six times because they just drove hard. They just didn't understand the chassis that much.
Wasn't he the only guy that didn't come back for the 100th anniversary? What was that all about?
Well, it's a long, convoluted story.
We'll do that another time.
No, he just... Gordy's like, too many foreign drivers. I don't want to sit next to some foreign guy. I'm like, Gordy, we'll sit you next to a couple of Americans. Bullshit. You never know why. They put me on them guys. I don't want to sit next to them. So this year, we have every year on Thursday before the race, we go to Charlie Brown. We go to Charlie Brown's every week anyway, but Charlie Brown's, we go to lunch, and Neto goes with us. This year it's going to be Rutherford, Parnelli, Uncle Bobby, Wally Dallenbach, Jigger Saroy, Johnny Parsons, Bill Vukovich, Pancho Carter, and Gordon Johncock's going to come for the first time ever. I don't think he's going to stay for the race. He wants to come to lunch because he wants to see Wally Dallenbach and Rutherford, and then he's going to drive to Carolina to see Cale Yarborough. But Gordy, he works 70 hours a week, Tom. He's got a pulp mill way up in northern Michigan where he used to work.
Yeah, is he in the UP? Or isn't he?
Yes.
Cold water?
Well, you know, even
he went back
he's
up,
in the UP.
Okay.
You're exactly right.
He was in cold water.
Right. It is such a drive to his place. But Gordy never made any money when he won Indy twice because he was married about 11 times.
And he's, what is he, 70-something?
Gordy is 79, 78.
Oh, wow.
Think about this. Mario's 79, Gordy's 79, Big Al's 80, Uncle Bobby's 84, AJ's 85, Parnelli's 86. I mean, they're all mentally still sharp as hell. That's what's so cool is that...
And part of it, I think, is especially you get someone like Mario that or AJ, they're so engaged in their lives. They've got so much to do. That's part of staying alive and staying alert. And
that's what worries us about Parnelli is most of his friends in L.A. are gone. They're dead. So he doesn't have... Because when he comes back every year for our lunch at Charlie Brown's, he goes, I wish we had something like this in L.A. I could do once a week. He just doesn't get out that much, you know, and it really helps. It helped kept Dan Gurney going. Gurney went to a shop every day and helps AJ going to his shop every day and getting on his bulldozer. And Uncle Bobby can't go too many places, but he's got a telephone, and that's all he needs.
Chat and keep engaged in life.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
well, let's circle all the way back. This has been a rather interesting journey for me. We've kind of gone a lot of different directions, which is how you get the good stuff, I think.
That's right.
Will there be another ABA reunion of the guys anytime soon? Has anybody ever said, look, we'll fly them all in?
That reunion we had last year. I wish you'd have come. Yeah, I wish you'd
tell them about where it was.
You know, we had the 50-year reunion last April, and it was down at Market Square, down at Baker's Life. They did a fabulous job, Dropping Dimes did, and they gave away rings, and we went to Butler Fieldhouse a Saturday afternoon for the autograph thing, and the guy said, well, nobody will show up. They were lined out in the parking lot, like 3,000 or 4,000 people, and all the guys. It was the biggest, supposedly Guinness Book of Records. We had 100 guys signing autographs at a table. They had 6 tables, and the guys just loved it. But, you know, once you get past the 50th, it's a very expensive thing to do. I mean, it costs a lot of money to do that. But
How about the classic Pacer players? How many are still around?
Well,
you mentioned was it 102 of
192 started when Neto started. Now they're down to 100.
Are
you talking about Indiana or the ABA?
The ABA.
Well, there's a lot of players that played 1 year or 2 years, but the guys that played 3 years or more
that are eligible theoretically for this pension, if
right,
it gets put together,
is about 100. And there's some of the guys that actually played 4 or 5 years in the NBA, got a little NBA pension. Whether they're eligible or not, I think they should be because they played 3 years. It's like 110, and we start out with almost 200. And they just, you know, like Skeeter Swift, I've got a recording of him. He called me. He just had surgery. He had 2 bouts of cancer. He had lymphoma. He had bad knee. It was really bad. And he called me from the hospital. He just got home and he said, hey, Nano, I just want to call you, tell you I'm okay. And da 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 da. And then he started crying on the phone. I mean, I've got this.
I listened to it.
He started saying, I want to thank you guys for, you know, for the trying to get us a pension. And, you know, he didn't have any money or anything. And 2 days later, he died.
Yeah. And there's a guy that played it.
And
there's a guy that played
it
for
Wayne
so mad, I was called Neto. Oh. Neto got him $50,000.
Yeah. And well, here's the thing: the guy didn't even know he was entitled to anything because the NBA, you know, again, the pension plan, what they did, the one that they supposedly had for the ABA was nothing. But they have federal regulations; you have to notify people.
Right.
They didn't do any of that. They had $1 billion in fines. They could, but this guy Willie Long, and he was dead broke, didn't have any money, and he called me crying on the phone. I said, "Look, I didn't do it." I said, "You know, we found out you didn't have it, and Scott Tarter, Dropping Dimes, took care of him.
They found him $50,000.
But right. it's just amazing how proud these guys. Another guy, and I'll make a long story short, down in Florida, he played here. He had 6 years in the league. He's living in Florida now in a little one-bedroom rental. He's living on $700 a month, Social Security. Played 5 years in the league. Well, the Dropping Dimes, all his teeth and his jaw was falling apart, and Dropping Dimes flew him up here. Steve Green, who's a dentist, got him some oral surgery.
Former IU player.
They did about 15, it really fixed him up so he could eat and everything for free.
Isn't that cool?
But he said he would not do it if people knew about it. He didn't want anybody to know. These guys are proud guys.
Yeah, they are.
And that's what, it's just a shame that they can't, you know, help him out. Because, hey, 6 years, $1,800 a month is a life changer for him.
Sure.
You know.
So we've come full circle.
Yes, we have.
And once again, you can find out more about the glory days of the book. Is called We Changed the Game, The Glory Days of the ABA.
Just remember, Bob, Tom, Bob.
I'm used to it.
Well, you don't look like, you don't have a mustache. chunk of proceeds of this book goes to the Dropping Dimes to help ABA players. And these are the guys that played 1 year, 2 years. Like they helped one guy who didn't have the money to bury his daughter that passed away, which was really sad.
How about that?
And so the Dropping Dimes helps guys like that. And there was a couple guys that played 1 year, but the one guy had some serious problems, and he helped them out. So this book serves a dual purpose. I mean,
I think enough information that we'll be getting out about this, I imagine that the higher ups in the NBA will go, hey, look, let's write a couple checks.
Right.
Having a good year.
Actually, the president of the NBA is a guy named Bob Cricky. Hell of a guy. Really nice guy. I think he's in our court. You know, there's all kinds of politics, but he was the main attorney that got the guys, the old timers, their money. He was the lead attorney. And I've talked to him about it, and I'm going to send him a book. And I think, I think with Bob Costas, and I know all these guys on our board of directors, like Spencer Haywood. I mean, our board of directors is pretty impressive on that Dropping Dimes. We got 8 Hall of Famers, George Gervin. We got Louis Dampier, Dan Issel, George Gervin, McGinnis, Slick. You know, all those guys are, fighting for this deal. And, hopefully things work out. And like I said, we really appreciate your help, too.
Oh, just passing the word along. We Changed the Game is the book. Bob Nedelicki, the late Richard Tinkman, and Robin Miller. And we're glad you guys are doing great. Robin, glad you're coming back. And I tell you what, let's make it a date. We'll figure out a time we can get some of those guys out at the track.
You come out to the track about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and we'll sit you down with Uncle Bobby and Parnelli, and you can just start listening.
Yeah, well,
you'll get to ask one question an hour with Uncle Bobby.
I'll take the beeping machine with me. Thanks, by the way, to Chris Geisen for engineering this for us.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks very much. And we'll be doing it again soon. Thanks very much. This is Tom speaking, and goodbye. Well, that was sure fun. Bob Nedelicki, basketball great, along with Robin Miller. We got a lot more podcasts coming up down the line. Thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.
The United States Soccer Federation presents the U.S. Soccer Podcast.
My name is David Goss, and I'm joined by my co-host, Megan Klinenberg.
Everything up until this point has been an outside look at the World Cup, and now we're giving people an inside look. It is just total pressure cooker.
Watching flags come out of little plastic balls is like the epitome of everything that I love. And the World Cup is everything. It's why I became a soccer fan.
The U.S. Soccer Podcast. Follow and listen on your favorite platform.